As far as I can make out, the university is crazy. This particular craziness is that next Wednesday, classes before 4 o'clock are canceled. The classes after 4 o'clock are supposed to occur. I decided this is too crazy to go along with. So my recommendation is that, since we're all tired and need a break, that we not have class next week and we'll use the last week of the semester for our final class. Does that sound sensible?
What day will that last class be then?
What? It's, I don't know, the 20th or 21st, something like that.
20, 19.
19. So we won't have class next week, so you can all leave here and go home tonight. So we have, unbelievably, one more interpretation of the deduction, at least to the extent that we're looking at. Guire's account of the harmony of the faculties. I want to say something about Dick Moran's talk. Let me say one word, for those who were there, for those who weren't there, you'll understand why I'm talking about. I think Moran offered an account that was worried about all the problems we've been worried about, and his solution, which he thought was a solution, was to go to Proust and say that the relationship between the reflective judgment and the object is one of overpowering love, that the object calls to you and beseeches you and addresses you, and this personification solves the problem in a way that Kant could not account for. However, he began his talk by setting up what I took to be the right problem, namely the problem of the fact that Kant wants two different things. On the one hand, he wants our relationship to the object of beauty to be free. He wants it to be a free play of the imagination, free play of the faculties, that we're not under any obligation to address the object, all of that. On the other hand, the second part of the puzzle is that once we do make the judgment of beauty, we say it is required of all others to agree. That it is as if they were under some demand that they agree with us about our judgment. And he could not see how you could get from freedom to a requirement. That was the puzzle he was trying to solve. And the reason why he used love is because at least the object of love, on his account, he read a passage from Proust, is something that calls out to us. So to ignore it would be a betrayal of the object to begin with. So he had the thought, right, that if to ignore the object would be a betrayal of it, as you would betray a lover, then, as it were, there is already a requirement up here. Now, the fact that as more than one person noticed that his readings of Proust were implausible, which is a bit surprising since Dick's been working on this Proust project for years and he's actually a wonderful Proust scholar. The passages he was reading were not about beauty, they're about something else. And in Proust, if you're interested, Proust has a wholly Platonic conception of beauty, very idealized. But what I didn't like about the solution above all is it drops the question of freedom. It answers the problem by denying the problem. Clearly, the original puzzle is the right puzzle. How do you get from a free comportment to an object to a situation where, on the basis of your judgment, you make, you know, it is beautiful as one that is as if required of everyone, that you speak with a universal voice. So you go from something like freedom to something like a requirement.
Yeah. So then why can't you have, like, okay, freedom to choose, like, anything at all, like, first, right? Okay, but it's like you have these many different forks in the road, right? And once you go down one, it's like that's what you do. But you have the choice to go down any one.
Except that it's the choice is stronger than that. In a way, that's kind of what he wanted to do. That is, once you turned your attention, then it was like choosing a lover, right? And it's all tied up. What's wrong with that is the freedom is not merely a freedom of choice about the object, it's a free play of the imagination. So, and he was further right, there was one further suggestion in his talk that was important, in that in making an aesthetic reflective judgment, we somehow, the direction of fit is one in which we are, as it were, making ourselves responsible to the object. That the direction of fit, although it's on one level beauty is apprehended, the apprehension is one which we feel connects with what must connect with what we take to be an intrinsic character of the form of the object. So the direction of fit really runs, ironically, in this direction. We adequate ourselves to the object rather than absorb the object to us. Well, those all seem to be important points in thinking about the problem, aren't they, Katie? So here's how I read that situation. Ask yourself the first question. What would it be for the direction of fit to be in this direction? What would count as absorbing the object to our subjectivity?
The agreeable
would be one version. My antecedent need. Yep, what else?
Well, the good. I mean, all of the...
The good, making the object has to agree with my conception of what is good. What else?
Understanding.
Understanding is, it has to agree with my conceptuality. So, the notion of freedom is, of course, freedom from, let's say that in this direction of subject, this direction is the direction of making the object agree, in some sense, with our constitutive subjectivity. That's why we absorb the object. It fits our needs, our concepts, our conception of morality. So freedom is freedom from, which is what Kant in part means by disinterestedness, freedom from constitutive subjectivity. So when I am judging the beautiful, I must expose myself to the object. I must overcome my standing needs, my standing desires, my standing forms of judging, my existing concepts. I must give up my morality, and what's left? Nothing but my naked subjectivity itself. All I am doing is, so the movement of freedom is the movement of what I call exposing myself to the object as it is in itself. It is the moment in which I give up everything that allows me to determine the world, and I let myself be determined by it. It's the experience of asking myself, can I bear it? So it is a subjectivity beyond constitutive subjectivity, beyond empirical subjectivity. Now, when I am so exposed to the object, then all I have is my imagination and my understanding. And reflective judgment is the naked exposure of me qua sensible subject. Still a subject, but a sensible subject because it's a free play of the imagination. Still a subject because it's imagination in relationship to the faculty of understanding. So it's me as sensible subject letting the object determine my capacities for responsiveness. Let me just finish off. And in going through that, what I am doing is, as I indicated when I quoted Adorno last week, adjusting my powers to the demands of the form of the object. That is, this exposure is mimetically retracing the object by its forms, right? And seeing if I can find in that exposure, in my sensible nakedness, that structure of harmony which is conducive to the needs of imagination and understanding and cognition in general. That is, that notion of complexity and unity. Now, and this is why I think it answers the puzzle. It seems to me that if I have done nothing more than abandon myself to the demands of the object, and that I then find it beautiful, it is only because I presume that I have discovered in the heart of my subjectivity its correspondence to the object, to its forms. That is what I must think I have found. But if I think I have found that, then of course it's exactly via my freedom that I generate the requirement. Because the direction of fit is so bound to the demands of the object that I am bound to think that everyone should judge as I do, because there's nothing else I can imagine being at stake in exposing yourself to this object. As the direction of fit really is me mimetically, reflectively, adjusting to the object and finding that it meets those, then that fact is, for me undergoing it, the sense of its rightness. So rather than thinking of freedom and requirement as in tension with one another, my claim is it's only from the perspective of freedom that the notion of requirement can enter in, because it's only from the position of freedom that the direction of fit works for me toward the object rather than me absorbing the object with respect to my existing structures. And it seems to me Moran fail to understand what disinterest or what freedom meant here. That is, I'm claiming exposure. Exposure to me, exposing myself to the object by letting myself be determined by its formal features. And therefore, which is why we always think the object is new. As the beautiful is new, because we have not predetermined it in accordance with our existing schemes. There can be no novelty without exposure. There can be no uniqueness without exposure. So, it seems to me Moran raised exactly the right questions. I think everyone in the audience felt that. And then simply avoided his own task. Or so I read. Questions about my... I wrote him a note to him, so that I'll let you know what he writes back. He's a friend, so... Maybe he's a friend. Maybe less of a friend than 4 days ago. Yeah.
I was wondering what you thought about the discussion afterwards. And Rebecca Kukla was interested in this. Where normativity... with normativity, we need some kind of requirements. It's like a soft requirement of the universality of it. I was expecting other people to also have this same experience.
I think Kukla's response was on the right track. Because what she was doing was trying to say that the kind of normativity we've been thinking about, let's call it Ingborgian normativity, that is taking my... My account here ties in with that, right? It's taking my reflective position to be as speaking with the universal voice. Kukla was roughly saying, shouldn't we always think that, even empirically? Right? So Kukla's strategy was to squeeze more... I thought, by the way, the responses were... her account was sharp and good. I mean, I really was impressed by it. And I thought going in that direction was fine, but she also dropped the problem of freedom. What she tried to do was try to make normativity more routinely available and therefore close the gap between the epistemic and the normative, which I think is, of course, the overall strategy that I'm following anyway. Right? But so, yeah, I thought it was a helpful set of responses. But she dropped the freedom problem. Ruby?
What? Oh, okay. So this is all happening within consciousness, right? It's not outside of it, right?
Of course.
Okay, so then you're really basically corresponding with yourself.
No.
Okay.
The object.
But, well, the object is yourself, or as it presents itself to you. It's within, it's like the otherness within you.
For Kant, that's an unnecessary metaphysical extra. All it is the object as apprehended. We're not asking idealism, realism. We're not asking any of those larger metaphysical questions, in part because this is a way of avoiding them.
Why would you want to avoid them?
Because they're unnecessary. This could help us find a form of materialism that would allow us to think that the idealism-realism structure is itself optional. So the reason why Kant's third critique is so important is it's part of a generalized, and this is available, by the way, in all the German idealists at various levels. It's a way of asking, of trying to get past the idealism-realism discussion by trying to find a way in which questions that seemed important previously drop out. Right? So there is no, because after all, I'm naked here. So the whole question about Kant, ideal and real turns on the constitutive powers of subjectivity. Well, that's what I'm free from. I've just given them up. So this is a version of what Deleuze would call transcendental empiricism. Right? This is not unlike his strategy of transcendental empiricism, in fact.
So like you're outside your consciousness almost? Because like it just...
No. Just not the question. Sometimes it's important. It's important here because the way in which philosophy advances is very often to suddenly find something you thought was a question stops arising as a question. So if we go to each object, each new thing, with our antecedent philosophical hat and say, it's either idealist or materialist, or it's either realist or reductionist, then we make it impossible to do philosophical discovery.
But I didn't say that.
Well, the question I'm saying, the question of whether it's in consciousness or not, it's me exposing myself by abandoning my position as transcendental, by abandoning it, and asking about that exposure.
So then where are you?
I am making Adorno would say that this is reversing the Copernican turn. Right? And that's part of, and now you say, well, but not completely. And no, not completely. Because I'm still, beautiful is still the object as apprehended. I'm not a realist. And beauty is still normative. I'm using a highly idealist. So I haven't gone to a form of realism. But yet the direction of fit has altered. That's the crux here. That's what makes it exciting, is that idealism thought, that was the Copernican turn. The Copernican turn was, let us stop asking, right, whether we can correspond to the object and make the object correspond to us. But in this account of beauty, Kant, I'm suggesting, is doing just the opposite, but under a new description, not under the description that was that of rationalism. So in fact, he's broken from, in the third critique, all the debates that led to Kant are themselves getting torn apart. So the question, is it in consciousness? No, it's, of course, we're judging as judges. We're too Kantian for that. We're never going to be dumb realists. But yes, I'm saying the object, the form of the object is demanding of me. I'm not observing it. I'm adequating myself to it. But in this new way. In this new way. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I wasn't here for this, or I wasn't there for the whole discussion.
No, sir. Any question is a good one.
but I'm sympathetic to how a Proust scholar would be able to see this question of freedom in the aesthetic experience and love posed there, especially as, at least in Swan's way, it feels like Proust's protagonist is in that place of complete exposure where he's entirely constituted by the object. But
what he gets there is an ideal. It's a Platonic account, because in that exposure there is a kind of essentialism that kicks in. So I agree you with Proust, there is an exposure to the Van Toy, for example. Right? So he has that moment. But then the result of that moment is a kind of ideal realm of essences, right? This is this is beauty itself.
But then to keep that from happening in your account, don't you have to have it keep cycling back to the freedom?
It has to keep cycling back, which is why it's as if a demand. I can't make anyone see it. I can't obligate even you to look at it. I am saying, when I speak with a universal voice, I am saying I can make no sense of what I am doing unless my exposure here is nothing but the adequate responsiveness, what is demanded of me by this object in my nakedness. And therefore, it happens not by saying, you must, but inviting you to share my suffering. Right? I'm using suffering now in its classical sense, right? Suffering wasn't pain, suffering is undergoing. Right? That's literally what suffering is. To suffer something is to undergo it. And the work of beauty is the undergoing, I'm saying, of the object. Yeah?
Why is this undergoing still not transcendental?
Because it... That's a great question. What? It is, all right, let me explain why it's a great question. Because I can see he's thinking, why is it a great question? It's a great question because the upshot of my sense of requirement is, of course, the belief that the object is purposive, right, for the mind, just purposive for the mind. So there is the transcendental principle of purposiveness, right? That there is a harmony between nature and me that is revealed, which vindicates the principle of purposiveness, right? The purpose of nature for us. I say that's only, and here's my thesis now, that the transcendental principle of purposiveness can only have empirical vindication. That is, it cannot be shown to be universally true. All I can do is gain evidence for it by discovering once again nature to be beautiful. So it inhabits the domain of the transcendental while not belonging fully to it, is my response. So the answer is that unlike the other transcendental conditions, think about it this way. Let me just make this a bit clearer. Oh, by those looks, I can see why you're looking hard at me. Normally for Kant, to say something is transcendental is to say it's a necessary condition for the possibility of experience. Secondly, Kant thinks that transcendental philosophy is to show a priori that such and such conditions are necessary conditions for the possibility of experience. What about the principle of purposiveness? We have already agreed, or the argument I've been running, is to say that unless the principle of purposiveness is satisfied, then we could not, unless we could schematize without concepts, we could not schematize with concepts. Right? That's the bottom line I've been running. The reason why that cannot be shown to be a priori the case is because it is possible for us to have experience, but our experience not to be of the world. Remember the problem with Kant, right? What I'm suggesting is one of the questions, we have a scheme of categories and concepts and all of that. And the hankering we all have, we want to know is, Yeah, but is that just the way we look at the world? Is that the way we just constitute it? Or does that really touch how the world is? That's what we want to know. And when we expose ourselves, when we abandon ourselves, I'm suggesting we abandon themselves because we want to have, and this is true for all of reflective judgment, this is equally true for the scientific case, it's because we want some sense that we are not merely imposing our conceptual scheme on the world, but that our conceptual scheme is a way of capturing how the world is. Right? But because you cannot have, do I want to say this? Tell me if I can say this. Because there cannot be a transcendental demonstration of the falsity of nominalism. What I mean is that we cannot. What I mean is we cannot get a transcendental guarantee that we are not merely imposing our conceptual scheme on the world, that we're not merely taking a wholly culturally, historically time-bound look at the world. We can never know for certain, overall, at a universal level, right, that we are not simply prisoners with our own conceptual scheme. My claim is that beauty and the sublime, we'll see later, really are ways of us trying to climb outside our own skin, to find ourselves in relationship to the object in ways that can let us know, but only one judgment at a time, that we are not merely imposing ourselves on the world, but discovering, even when we're not trying to impose our demands on the world, there is a fitness between human subjectivity and the way the world is. Now, if you're a skeptic, by the way, your answer is, well, of course you're going to do that. It's called evolution, stupid. And that's right. That's why there can't be, you can never get rid of that hankering. There's no permanent resolution to the hankering. This is, aesthetics is the strategy of testing ourselves against what exceeds our normal powers of constituting the world. That's the thrill of the aesthetic. Does that help?
Is that the transcendental, but it's still not transcendental?
It inhabits the transcendental realm, but it's not an a priori demonstration, it's an empirical demonstration.
Of transcendentality.
Of transcendentality, yeah. And because empirical, therefore not conclusive, right? It's only, it belongs to, or you might say it becomes part of, almost a material a priori of our account of the world. Yeah.
So I would imagine someone would say, well, doesn't that make the whole transcendental apparatus, sort of apparatus redundant? And we need to, right, and turn to this empirical way.
No, it does make it redundant. It shows it's partial. And what it shows is that it's interested. And what it shows is, and then you have to ask, what is that interest? And if you're an Adornonian, you're going to say it's the interest of instrumentality and control. It's a way of looking at nature for the sake of control, manipulation, and scientific understanding. But there are other ways of encountering the world. So this exposes us to a way of encountering the world that is not dependent on a transcendental interest. Hence the notion of disinterest. The notion of disinterest is part of this notion of freedom. Right? So it's not that we can quite get rid of that stuff because we can't get rid of our needs. If the transcendental is really a code for how we must view the world if we're going to survive in it at all, right? That's one way of thinking about it. What transcendental means is functionally necessary for for us qua sensible agents. And Kant just hid that. But by the way, the notion of functionality became actually crucial to the neo-Kantian movement in Germany in the 19th century, above all in the philosophy of Ernst Cassirer. If you want to see that move, the co-retelling of idealism, his great book is From Substance to Function. Right? So he's defending Kant, but he's saying we move from thinking about substances to thinking about how things work in relationship to one another. I'm saying I want something more. I'm hankering for the world. Yeah.
Sure. What you said just now when you were talking about it was that we turn to these things because we desire the feeling that we are able to access the world without the imposition of our conceptual scheme.
Turn to them. We find ourselves. Let me rephrase that. We find our when we have experiences of beauty, we come to prize it and to cultivate it because. And now here's the answer. Right, so one of the things I said last week, I'm glad you brought that up, because last week I said when you compare the different accounts of the deduction, ask yourself what each of them is saying about what the interest of disinterest is. That is, why do we care about beauty at all? And on this account, we care about beauty because it puts us in harmony, right, or attunement with nature as a sensible being. While if you think of the second view we looked at last week, Beatrice Longuenesse's, it's not really harmony with nature she's interested in. She's interested in community of sensible beings in their relationship to the natural world. But her thing, as she said, when she talked about spirit at the beginning and this business about community at the end, her view is really driven by a kind of idea that we should be united as a community of sense as well as a community of reason. I think that's what's driving the Longuenesse view. Very different. And well, here we have to figure out what the third view is. So each account of beauty, and every time you face an account, you want to ask, why? Why bother? If it's not to know the good, Plato's answer, part of the latter, I'm suggesting it is part of our sensible attunement to the world as natural creatures. Now you can ask your question.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's
how I meant to start today anyway.
You kind of answered more on this. I mean, I guess what I was wondering from the way you put it, but it seems that one of the things, I think one of the things that Dorno is saying for all time and everywhere is quite how very, very difficult it is to rid oneself of interest.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And
almost impossible.
Conceptual violence, right?
Yep.
And so
great.
There does seem to be something difficult about wanting to make this part of the kind of almost the sort of grammar of aesthetic encounter and thereby show that it's happening necessarily and if that's what happened to me.
No, because what I haven't said is how this occurs. When are we free? How do we get free? How difficult it is? How usual is it? You know, what do we need to be free? Right? And I agree with you. On my account, it's both the case that every object is potentially beautiful. It just so happens it's almost impossible. Right? And the argument is, think about the way I often try to make this argument is from Heidegger's argument in the Age of Technology essay. And he says, look at the Rhine now. And he says, what is the Rhine now? And you might say, you know, a broad, powerful, you know. He says, no, it's an object for the tourist industry. And in saying that, he's saying, even when we're nose to nose with nature, we are so embedded in cultural cliches. In, you know, you drive along a beautiful road now and it has tourist vantage point. It's like telling the Japanese, get in your car here and take a picture, right? But that means it's already been framed, coded as beautiful without you having to confront it. So you don't expose yourself to it, you take it as a cliche of beauty. Right? And I take it this is why avant-garde art has become difficult, because it realizes if it delivers beauty over to us easily, there's no beauty. It's just another cliche. So Kant assumed a more ready access to it. But I'm saying the principle nonetheless holds. So I'm defending the thesis without defending that. And we'll come back to that with Guyer. Guyer kind of touches on some of these issues. Okay, yeah?
That almost seems to open up into like a Griard simulacrum lace world that we can't really get outside of except for the possibility of the beauty.
There are different ways of thinking about how we account for the difficulty. Baudrillard's is one clumsy view, in my view. But it certainly has the agreement with him that we should not be naive about our own experiences and the extent to which our experiences, even when they seem raw, might be themselves already simulacra. That's certainly right. Okay? You ready to start the hour?
Good. Now, I think that was worth doing that.
Can I ask a procedural question? What should we read for next week? I mean, it's something stupid. I mean, should we read The Sublime?
Oh, I hope to get even to say The Sublime. Okay. So The Sublime is the next thing.
Okay.
But we may not get there.
It seems like on your account, though...
But not next week. Next week off.
Then the reason we care about beauty is because we want... Ultimately, that our conceptual scheme will capture how the world... I mean, it seems like you're almost bringing it back into being a point about epistemology, like, well, because we have this...
Well, I am asking a quasi-epistemological question, namely, what we want is a sense that our judgments about the world... we want a way of thinking about the world that acknowledges its full independence from us as best we can. And we are interested in understanding how we are located not above the world, but in the world as a sensible creature whose attachment to the world must be by our capacities for sensible response, rather than making the notion of sensible response merely, right, the conduit for information that's going to be processed by the brain that's going to conceptualize it. We want our sensibility to have a stronger speaking voice, and by that means have the objects we acknowledge have a speaking voice. And we want that, again, because we want to judge objects in their individuality, their uniqueness, and not merely as cases or specimens falling under antecedent universals. And we think we need that because we think if we don't have that, then we can't have morality either. Or we can't have love, or we can't have something about our engagements with the world seem to require that we not always judge everything via an old blueprint, but sometimes let that judgment and that response be to it. Certainly, my lover does not want to hear when she asks, why do you love me, if I say, because you're just the kind of girl I would love. Being a good specimen of the kind doesn't always work. Now, sometimes it does, right? Sometimes I love a chocolate cake because it's just the kind, right? Sometimes we want that. But I'm saying there are rows of instances where we think uniqueness matters, and art has always been that domain where, because of the irreducibility of the sensible to the universal, this is what this is about, finally, that we think that art is always the bearer of something beyond being just another case, right? Which is why, of course, it was anathema to Plato. If you think reality is nothing but universals, then nothing is worse than the merely sensible. And how even, you know, Aristotle, he had to get past that. Hence introduced phronesis, introduced all sorts of mechanisms within a rationalist framework to try to engage particular cases. Terribly. And reflective judgment, as I've said a couple of other slides, reflective judgment is worth comparing to Aristotelian phronesis as models of judgments of particulars, right? That they are the only forms I know of.
Abduction,
Peirce, the three. Abduction and Peirce, phronesis and Aristotle, reflective judgment and Kant are...
Projection in Wittgenstein. Or Cavell's notion of projection in Wittgenstein.
That's a harder one, though, isn't it? Yes, but it is.
Sure.
But, but notice how rare the cases are. Notice how rare the cases are. And then it becomes an issue. It becomes an issue in contemporary philosophy, obviously, in lots of writers. We think about it in different ways. What interests me in Kant, Aristotle, and Peirce is they want uniqueness or specificity or particularity within reason, not outside reason. One way of thinking about the particular is it always exceeds reason altogether. But reflective judgment and phronesis are forms of reason, forms of judgment. Therefore, they are capacious ways of expanding, oops, epistemology, expanding our epistemic repertoire. So that's the point. So that was a little aside. Okay, Guire. So we had two views last week, which I've already summarized with their different interests. Guire's essay is an essay not about the deduction, but about three views of the harmony between the faculties, but that tacitly implies a different deductive strategy if you have a different view of the meaning of the harmony of the faculties. And what is, I think, useful, more than useful, about Guire is he suggests that there are three different ways of thinking about the harmony of the faculties. Three different basic strategies. He calls them the precognitive strategy, the multi-cognitive strategy, and the one he's going to favor is the meta-cognitive strategy. And at least initially distinguishing these is, I think, useful. Each of them, I think, is suggests various different ways of thinking, and they take us in different directions. So let's start. Now, so metacognitive is going to be his own, so he's going to first elaborate these two and then dump them, show why they're inadequate, and then move to his metacognitive approach. Well, this is the one I've just been beating to death for the last 2 weeks. That is, it satisfies the condition for cognition except for that of the actual application of the concept. So it is the subjective conditions for objective judgment. And interestingly enough, Andrea Kern, in her wonderful book, Schöne Lust, calls this the material strategy, or the materialist strategy. And she calls it a materialist strategy because she's thinking of Paul de Man's great essay on Kant, when de Man gives the scenario that I just gave of this exposure to the object, he reads it as it were, nothing but a material relationship between me and the material world. It's as if we could really shuck off all that conceptual stuff and finally reach that material relation between a subject and an object. The precognitive view is, of course, the view that I've been forwarding, but you can also find it in Dieter Henrich, Donald Crawford, Rudy McCreel. Hanna Ginsborg is using a version of it for sure. So that view we already know. The second view, the multi-cognitive, Kern calls this the hermeneutic one. Strategy. And in this strategy, the object satisfies all the conditions for judgment, for cognition, but in an indeterminate way. That is, in a way in which it's not that there's no conceptuality, it's rather that there is an open-ended manifold of concepts that are suggested by the manifold of intuition. That the thought here is that the object is suggestive of various ways in which it might be conceived or understood, various ways in which it grabs our attention. So he is fond of an article that I had not read prior to his picking it out, but now read by my friend Fred Rush. So I feel bad that a friend did it and I didn't know. And it's called The Harmony of the Faculties. It appears in Konstudien in 2001. It's number 92-1, 2001. And in it, Rush says, in the case of the aesthetic function, the intuitively given is not subsumed under a determinate concept, but under a multitude of concepts playfully applied to it. That aesthetic reflection and the harmony of the faculties, perception is a taking of the manifold as having one among many potential possible characters, a state in which it is implicitly registered that what is perceived is one way, but that does not foreclose, indeed it rests upon other ways it might be subject to synthesis. And finally, if you think about it, Allison, in fact, ends up probably with a multi-cognitive view. He actually flip-flops, I think, between precognitive and multi-cognitive. But at least on page 71, he says the following that certainly fits the multi-cognitive picture. Namely, the basic idea is presumably that the imagination, in its free play, stimulates the understanding by occasioning it to entertain fresh conceptual possibilities, while conversely, the imagination, under the general direction of the understanding, strives to conceive new patterns. patterns of order. So in the multi-cognitive view, what you are, and it obviously, the idea of hermeneutic is a nice one here, because it's the idea that what's going on is a insistent interpretive endeavor that has no closure, but rather wants that very suggestiveness of interpretive possibilities.
So your viewpoint combines these, right? Because you say outside subjectivity, as if outside, with the question about how it's not transcendental. Right? So it remains this kind of interpretive pattern.
It remains indeterminate, but I don't think of it as suggesting multiple different conceptualities at all. On the contrary, if my direction of fit argument is the right way of going, then I would be closing down the thought of multiple different ways and thinking, no, there's a compellingly overall way in which I am adequating myself to it. So no, I think there's a real tension between the precognitive and the multi. I think those two really are in tension with one another. What are Guire's objections to these two? His objection to the precognitive, it's the old one. It's the standard objection, namely, it entails that all objects are potentially beautiful. And he says two things. Gee, ain't that silly? And secondly, Kant never suggests this. And when he says Kant never suggests this, he points to the wild beauty passages where Kant says that it's those. Now, since I spent ages last time answering that objection, I won't do it again. But even Guire has to acknowledge that the question must arise of which objects and under what conditions do we find them beautiful, which is to say, under what conditions can we abstract from our interests, and if we cannot abstract from our interests, why not? Further, the question must arise, which objects facilitate the play of faculties? And what does it mean to claim that some objects facilitate the play of faculties more radically than do others? So he understands that there may be ways in which, and in that passage he criticizes me. I should have mentioned that. I think it's called full disclosure. Against the multi-cognitive theory, he says simply, there's simply no evidence that Kant suggests this, that the judgment of beauty, Kant says, requires no concept, not no determinate concept. And Kant further says it's only the faculty of the concepts that are at stake. So it seems to play fast and loose with Kant's account. Secondly, a philosophical problem, according to Guire, namely, why would an experience of flitting, I'm quoting now, back and forth among an indeterminate multitude of concepts for a single object be found pleasing? Now, I should, let me answer, I mean, although I don't think the multi-cognitive view is Kant's view, I think Guire is unfair. So let me say what I think is behind the multi-cognitive view, because I think it's not uninteresting. I think there are two thoughts, at least, behind the multi-cognitive view. First, in the multi-cognitive view, plainly, because it's hermeneutical, gets its chops from works of art. It obviously works best for them. And one of the thoughts that's behind it is that we find works of art are somehow deep and inexhaustible. That they bear further seeing, further reading, further hearing, and that the reason that we find further seeing, further reading, and further hearing required of us is because we feel that no one take on them, no one engaging with them, exhausts their potentialities. And if we think that they have, therefore, more potentialities, not just for putting us in a state, although that's one explanation, by the way, but it's in a state, right, that our mind keeps going, but because we think there is something suggestive about it. And the best way of thinking through that claim is to ask yourself, why is it we believe that good metaphors are not fully paraphrasable? That is, I take it, Arthur Danto somewhere says, actually all art is just big metaphors. It's not a crazy thought. I don't know if it's right. It's not terribly helpful either, but it gets at something that's deep, right? And that is what we find important about metaphors is that they force on us in their collision of concepts ways of thinking about phenomena that no literal statement, no paraphrase, quite captures. So that metaphors really are, in the precise sense, suggestive of different and multiple conceptualizations. And it is indeed difficult to think that we could have anything like what we would think of as art if we didn't have the capacity for something like metaphor. Metaphors are indeed cases of new conceptualizations. Conceptualizations beyond existing conceptualizations. And indeed, we may think that one of the ways that human thought advances is via the process of metaphorization. That is, we get past our existing place precisely by generating metaphors that take us into new areas of thinking. So, at least for cases of art, I think there's quite a bit to be said about the multi-cognitive view. Yeah?
It just seems like the multi-cognitive view would require some kind of subsumption for the picking up and the carrying off to something new. And so it's saying no.
No, but the thought is it's an indeterminate subsumption. That's its hope. It's hope that it's not merely subsumptive. It's indeterminately subsumptive. I'm saying it's this. I'm saying, so, again, what we're saying is there's more to the object than our powers of determining it. So the multi-cognitive view also is a way of trying to say the object has an excess to it. And you'll see, even in his metacognitive, it's always about excess. There's got to be more to it than our usual or habitual ways of engaging. And that's going to be on any of the three views, that's the case. Sorry, I wanted to finish that thought. No?
I have asked. answer the question. Yeah, it just seems like, yeah, I understand what you're saying. Like, it's no one subsumption is going to be sufficient, and there is going to be this excess and something that can't seem to be swept up in any one subsumption. But I guess I'd gotten used to the idea that the free play between the imagination and the understanding required no subsumption whatsoever.
So I think that's right. And what I would say is the multi-cognitive view has a hard time thinking about the beauty of nature. I don't think that when we look at a beautiful tulip, it's suggestive of multiple concepts. So it seems to be very heavily flavored to art. And of course, you know, that is one direction. I mean, many people who are in this conversation are tacitly saying, go read Hegel. I'm trying to get rid of the beauty of nature. Only the precognitive view, well, not quite. But the precognitive view, of course, is driven by natural beauty, and it's going to have to suffer difficulty when it comes to art beauty. And then we're going to have to ask ourselves the question, when we get to the question of art beauty, how do we relate art beauty and natural beauty? I mean, this is going to be a real topic, because these various accounts have different strengths and weaknesses for those two cases.
Seems like the multi-cognitive view would have more to do with our desire to express the beauty of this object to other people, and you know, in our desire to communicate it, which is ultimately beauty.
But again, I think that's right for natural beauty. But think about a poem, and you feel that a poem is getting at something that you know is suggestive about what is love or death or loneliness, you know, whatever the poem or a wheelbarrow on a road, you know, whatever your moment is, that has this slightly hermeneutical suggestiveness. I think those work moderately well. If I'm right about the fallacy of paraphrasability, that is, all metaphors can be paraphrased. If I'm saying that thesis is false, then there's got to be something to the multi-cognitive view. Even if it doesn't fit Kant. That was what I was suggesting. I didn't want to let it go. I'm trying to say it came out of some insight into the region of aesthetics and art, maybe just not the authentically Kantian one. Yeah?
Well,
who? Oh.
He had a question as well. That question is, multi-cognitive means it offers a series of determinate cognitions.
Yes.
But it could mean simply it offers a series of possibilities for being conceptualized, but for which we might not have the concepts that themselves require. So it's indeterminate, not just not any particular interpretation fits, but it somehow seems to constantly throw up regularities, forms, something that to be conceptualized, but then nonetheless we don't have concepts for. So then it doesn't seem
that would drift it back to the precognitive. I think the sense is it must be a series or plurality of conceptualizations. That's why Kern calls it hermeneutical. It has different interpretive possibilities.
But I mean, you look at a cloud and say, oh, it looks like a horse, now it looks like a tree. I mean, you say, or it looks kind of like a horse, but it's not. There's sort of two different.
Yeah, but that's that's cognizing, and B, it's not even clear that it has much to do with the beautiful. That's part of our
art.
That's something else we're interested in there, maybe projecting on the natural world.
So could this view be attached to pleasure? Would it be attached to pleasure sort of through interpretive playfulness, wit, using metaphor to explode?
Mm-hmm.
So you could get pleasure back in, so it could handle that. I mean, it's obviously not Kant.
Right, he didn't have the pleasure, right. And the playfulness, yes, wit is a nice way of thinking about, would fit with German Romanticism very nicely in that way. I think that's right. Okay. Should we take a break? Do you need a break? Or do you want to go on with this and then come back to this a while? Keep going. Okay, let's finish this off. I'll see if I can do it quick. So Squire's negative thesis, the one that Pandick has been worried about since week one, I think, is, according to Squire, we always, for any judgment of beauty, must use some determinate concepts. So he wants to say, when we say something is beautiful, we must say it's the F that is beautiful, that the sunset is beautiful, the hummingbird is beautiful, that phrase is beautiful. So that what harmony the faculty... So first, what he's thinking here is, if you're a Kantian, then it has to undergo some syntheses, so it's got to come up as an object somehow, and if it's going to come up as an object somehow, after all, it's not just any old thing, if it's a one thing, then we've already, as it were, synthesized it and conceptualized it to some degree, and that therefore it's not simply it is beautiful, but the F is beautiful. Harmony, then, he says, requires only the absence of any concept of a determinate intended end or use of the object of experience. So, of course, I recognize the sun as sun, but I don't have to, as it were, do all the paraphernalia of the sun, thinking of the sun as what keeps us warm, or thinking of it as, you know, what is part of the structure of the planetary system. I'm just looking at it as, boy, that's a beautiful sunset. That's his thought. So it doesn't harm the possibility of judgment to bring in, let's call it a weak and no determinate end or use concept under which I bring it. So, another way of thinking about this, he suggests, is that a determinate end of the mind is satisfied, but in an unusual way. That is, our determinate end of conceptualization or finding harmony is satisfied, but in an unusual way. So on page 183, he says, it is also a state of mind in which it is felt that, or as if, the understanding's underlying objective or interest in unity is being satisfied, but in a way that, here's the meta, goes beyond anything required for or dictated by satisfaction of the determinate concept or concepts on which mere identification of the object depends. A beautiful object can always be recognized as an object of some determinate kind, but our experience of it always has even more unity and coherence than is required for it to be a member of that kind, or has a kind of unity and coherence. By the way, I find that phrase incoherent. What is it to say it has more unity and coherence than is required? Yeah, I mean, this is kind of... But the next phrase is that, yeah... Just bizarre. This is when you know a philosopher is, by the way, an automatic pilot. You can see why he said it. He just didn't think about what he said. Right? Or, this is better, has a kind of unity and coherence that is not merely a necessary condition for our classification. Although, again, that's a bit weird. What's having more than is necessary to be called a rose? More roseness? It's not quite. But the thing is, he wants the notion of more. He says we can, and indeed must be able to have our ordinary cognition of the object, but we experience it as beautiful precisely because we experience it as inducing a degree or type of harmony between imagination and understanding that goes beyond whatever is necessary for ordinary cognition. Okay. I won't read out all the passages. That certainly is the thought. Well, of course, in part, he's thinking about the wild passage, right? That seems to have more than routine or geometric or simple coherence. The question is simply this. This is my problem with it, to which I have a partial answer, but it's not the one he suggests. What is the pleasure of the more? Again, my question is simply, what is the interest of this beauty now? That it satisfies it in a new way. Well, what does that do for me? And why would I care? So it seems as if there's a more. This more is now, I would argue, an inscrutable extra. And he gives us no clear idea of what would make that inscrutable extra significant. So he says, just to give you one more passage so I'm not defaming him, and then I'll suggest what he might be thinking about, although he would deny it. But if the pleasure in beauty is to be noticeable, and the imagination is to be free, the satisfaction of the underlying objective of cognition must be in some way unexpected. That's what he's interested in, that we're surprised by beauty, which is a nice thing. And not determined by any rule. The only way to put all these assumptions together is to suppose there's something more. Well, the only, and I simply, it's not that he doesn't have some phenomenological rightness to what he's suggesting. I want to suggest, so let me say, there's something phenomenologically suggestive about this way of thinking about it. The difficulty I have is that it's unclear why something being more suggestive than everyday objects for our powers of understanding and imagination should be regarded as something that we care about. And therefore, again, the question is not that this is fundamentally right, it simply leaves us with a puzzle. What is the source of the more? One possibility that we have talked about is the suggestion that those objects, those perceptual objects that possess an excess of form beyond the normal capacities of the understanding are the living ones. That is, it seems to me that the metacognitive, if it's to kick in, has to go in one of two ways. It has to either go, which by the way it does in his account, towards art. So we love art because it satisfies our understanding this is a marriage. Whoa, that's a marriage, right? I mean, in art we get a real explosion of our ordinary conceptual understanding. But if it's natural beauty, I think it must go towards the question of organic form, as that which exceeds... Exceeds what? One of the suggestions I've been making, and I'll just leave this, one of the suggestions I'm now tracking down, so you can hear my little hobby of trying to argue with respect to Picasso, is that we have two irreducible ways of organizing the visual world. Number one, the one that Kant laid out in his Transcendental Aesthetic, is called geometry. That is, we can always think that the possibilities of comprehending a visual array are to be ordered in terms of our capacities for geometric understanding. But Kant suggests, in the notion of the ideal of beauty, that there's another irreducible way in which we perceptually organize the world, namely in accordance with living form. That is, the notion of particularly the human person, I want to suggest is a material a priori of our visual encounters with experience. Which is to say, to see something, this is an argument I suggested earlier, to see something as a living being, right, is irreducible. But to say it's irreducible is to say that it cannot be reduced to mere geometrical accounting. So that there is a claim that, I mean, after all, Kant thought that Euclidean geometry exhausted our understanding of spatiality. I'm suggesting that cannot be right. That our very capacity to recognize living beings as living exceeds whatever visual capacities we have, and that in recognizing living beings, it's not simply that they're in space, they organize space in a non-geometrical way. That is, they elaborate space. Think of the... Of course, this is there in all over Merleau-Ponty, of course. I think of it, the simplest way to think of it is the sculptures of Anthony Caro. You all know the... sculptures of Anthony Caro. So, one of his great sculptures is called Bennington. Prairie. Prairie is this extraordinary long piece of orange piping structure. And in order, as you see it, it is no longer in space. Rather, what the work does is spatialize. That is, it creates, I want to say, flatness as a domain of habitation. It is the experience of space as stretching out and at a distance in some way. And to begin thinking that space is something that has a... So when faced with this, by the way, there's a whole literature on Kant and spatiality. And some people say, ah, yes, there are two types of geometry. There's the literal geometry, and then there's what's called perceptual geometry. You know, because for perceptual geometry, what rules does perceptual geometry break of ordinary geometry? Anyone? Train tracks. Yeah, I mean, parallel lines meet in perceptual space, right? But my thought is, don't go that way. That's giving into the claim that it's always geometrical. I'm suggesting that you may think that living things spatialize, that is, create forms of form, organization, that is not reducible to geometry. Why? Because it has an expressive dimension, and the expressive dimension is it's alive. Something like that. So the more of the metacognitive would be the more of organic form. And I'm suggesting the notion of organic form, which is a problem, always a problem in aesthetics. And because people never know whether to think of it as a bad thing or a good thing. Because people think organic form, oh, isn't that idealizing the notion of form? Isn't that using the notion of human beings and giving everything in accordance with that? Isn't that creating too much harmony in the world, right? And whole critique of whether artwork should have organic form. I'm suggesting that the notion of organic form is at least irreducible to geometric form. And when Kant says we acknowledge formal purposiveness, I believe that can be decoded as organic form. And that might be a reason to go metacognitive. Okay, let's have a break there. So that